And now, let's take you all the way back to November 2008. That In The Loop hit, heard by literally dozens of people. It was all the rage at the time. Hope you enjoy this blast from the past.
We count fever.
Have you got it?
Catch it.
Hand counting all the ballots, we can make the winner clear.
We count the fever.
Have you got it?
I've got it.
Please tell me more, this is all I want to hear.
We count the fever.
Have you got it?
Catch it.
Oh, looks like our Franken got himself a second chance.
We count the fever.
Have you got it? When I see those stacks of ballots, makes me wanna win my pants.
Well, the canvassing is done. The tally's been reset.
Rarely have I had so much fun in my job as when I produced that little nugget. But now it's over. It's over. Love him or hate him, we now have a senator here in Minnesota. And fortunately, there are lots of other interesting things to talk about today on In The Loop. Hello, everybody. I'm Jeff Horwich. And in fact, we will have one last parting shot of Senate race-related music for you a little later in the show. And speaking of stories you may have had your fill of by now, I can promise you just a couple of brief, thoughtful references to Michael Jackson along the way. Not too many. And only one reference, as a matter of fact, to the dearly departed Billy Mays, which will come right now, just because I want to.
Does your toilet have hard water stains or a ring of rust that keeps coming back? Now you can throw away your brush and never scrub your toilet again. Guaranteed. Introducing Kaboom Never Scrub. It installs in seconds.
That guy was a force. And arguably a heart attack waiting to happen, right? But thought we'd give him a little nod here. And Farrah Fawcett, of course, and Ed McMahon. Oh, and by the way, while you're out, the House passed a giant climate change bill. And Walmart says it's okay for the government to force companies to provide health insurance. And evidently, airplanes are crashing now. What is going on with the world? That is sort of a multi-episode question, I guess, but we're working on it. Still lots of fascinating activity in Iran. And I tell you, we're working on a very interesting source to talk about that for our next episode. So stick with us. But in the meantime, we're going to check in next door to Iran because it's been a very exciting few days in Iraq. U.S. troops met their deadline to pull out of the cities, and the Iraqi government declared a new national holiday in honor of our leaving Sovereignty Day. With all that's been going on there, we thought it'd be a good time to put Iraq back on the Minnesota Public Radio phone bill and put a call in to Roman Zagros, who's joined us before on In the Loop. Roman, thanks very much for talking with us again.
You're welcome.
Quick bit about him. He works for the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. He's Iraqi himself and editor-in-chief of Metro, which is a daily magazine that kind of moves around the country to different places and trains Iraqi journalists to cover election-related news. So first question for you, Roman. What kind of crazy partying did they do in Iraq for the very first Sovereignty Day?
Yeah, I mean, the mood on the street was just a picture of excitement. The police were actually leading the celebrations and also a national anthem being played. This is something actually quite intense to the Iraqis. There was some slight fear by some Iraqis. I mean, it's new to them. You know, the same way the Americans' presence was new to them, their withdrawal is also actually new to them now.
And you are in Sulaymaniyah, which is in the northern part of the country, correct?
Yeah, sure.
And you're saying people were genuinely excited about this. I mean, it's sort of a manufactured holiday, right? And we've been hearing conflicting reports, some saying that people were underwhelmed. It was hard to get excited about it. But in Sulaymaniyah, there was some real, genuine, authentic happiness, you think?
Not really. I mean, in the north, the election has completely actually overshadowed anything else. But as a matter of fact, the withdrawal of the American forces will never be celebrated in Kurdistan. This is considered basically their kind of big brother, you know, people who they can turn to in times of trouble.
Outside of the Kurdistan region where you are right now, do you think generally anybody is going to miss us, the United States?
I think you guys won't be missed much, to be honest with you, in the rest of the country. I think if you look at Baghdad, for instance, for quite a while, we have been seeing the Iraqi army controlling all the checkpoints. So the people are much happier with the Iraqi checkpoints they are, to them, much friendlier.
What happens if the army isn't strong enough to keep things together, though? I mean, we still hear about bombings, of course, and we hear about other countries perhaps meddling in the affairs of Iraq.
Well, that's actually a very important question to be asked, to be honest. But I think the Iraqi army, anyways, lacks the Air Force, so it will rely on the American forces if it needs a major operation somewhere in the country. But it has been claiming, all the commanders have been claiming that they will be actually ready and prepared to take over with no problems.
Do you personally think, Roman, that they are ready?
I think, to be honest, there are tensions. That's the problem. I mean, there are political tensions. Let us say we have a major split between Sunnis and Shiites. And, of course, you would see the army would split along sectarians or whatever lines. Everyone has different loyalties and allegiances.
Speaking of persistent divisions within the country, let's talk about those elections coming up in Kurdistan in the north, which is where you are now and what you've been working on. What's at stake with those elections coming up later this month?
For decades now, the Kurdish politics have been completely dominated by two major political parties. That is the party of the Iraqi president, the PUK, and the party of the Kurdistan region president, that's the KDP.
This is the Iraqi Kurdistan parliament you're talking about, right? Which has quite a bit of autonomy.
Yes, the Iraqi Kurdistan parliament, yes. Up until now, PUK and KDP have been making decisions behind closed doors. And they have been actually communicating these decisions to the parliament, to their MPs, to their deputies in parliament. And they have actually voted on them blindly. So the parliament was actually, in essence, not a very effective parliament.
So why are these elections going to shake things up so much?
We are going to see a major opposition in parliament soon. This sense of competition so far hasn't existed in Kurdistan. Huh. And it is going to improve things, in my opinion. I just sensed what the people have been anticipating is an effective parliament that would actually monitor the government as opposed to implementing its decisions. Because the Kurdistan region is actually has been suffering at many levels from corruption. And this is not something that actually the senior politicians have denied.
One last question for you, maybe off in just a slightly different direction, but I'm curious, are people in Iraq talking about Michael Jackson?
Michael Jackson was hugely popular over here. I remember the town of Sulaymaniyah. I used to see boys, teenage boys, all of them in uniform socks, white socks and black flat shoes, dancing what they call breakdance. Always the sound of Michael Jackson used to be on the streets.
Really?
And I see many people now in my age completely devastated by his departure. And I'm one of them.
I think we underestimate how attached people in other parts of the world were to Michael Jackson.
That's also maybe due to the fact that many of his recent controversy, hasn't been really communicated to these societies over here. And they have never actually taken any notice of it. It's not their problem. What they want was Michael's songs, his music.
Well, Roman, thanks very much for your thoughts on that and for everything else over the last few minutes.
Cheers. Thank you very much.
That's Roman Zagros, who works for the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. He's the editor-in-chief of Metro, which is a magazine helping Iraqi journalists to cover election-related news for the upcoming Kurdistan elections. While we are on the topic of Michael Jackson, Lord knows you don't need a lengthy discourse from us about that, but we did receive a nice little unsolicited poem from our occasional news poet, Aaron Bells, who is out in California. And I'd like to share that with you now.
Elegy for Michael. Michael Jackson, dead and gone, king of pop, the moon's own son. The earth was yours, so was the night. Neon and sparkles, hearing, sight, a velvet touch, fedora white. Michael, tell me, if you know, what power makes the dark to glow? What fancy, fake, elaborate lie must I tell myself to keep dancing under the stars you hung so exactly where they are?
Aaron Bells lives in the Los Angeles area. He's got a book of poetry out not too long ago called The Bird Hoverer. You can learn more about him at bells.net. And now you don't have to have a book out or your last name as a website to send us your brief poems on the news. We definitely want to hear them, and we've been putting more and more of them on the show when we can. You can find a form to do just that, to send them to us at intheloopshow.net. Now, easily the most tantalizing story of the pre-Michael Jackson period of this news cycle was the disappearing governor, Governor Mark Sanford of South Carolina, who allegedly at first was off hiking the Appalachian Trail, decompressing or whatever after a difficult legislative session. And of course, we now know he was in Argentina, of all places, decompressing in a somewhat different fashion with his paramour there. And it'd be easy to just let that go as the politician sex scandal of the week, right? But this one was so colorful and so egregious that it just made me think about, I don't know, this kind of stand-by-your-man syndrome that now we've seen in so many of these cases, whether it's Eliot Spitzer, Senator John Ensign just recently, the senator from Nevada, who else? John Edwards, Senator David Vitter, who went to prostitutes or whatever. He's a senator from Louisiana. Who else am I forgetting about here? Larry Craig, I guess, who never really admitted to anything, although sure seems like he did it. And his wife was there right beside him. And in all of these cases, the wives are right there saying, we're committed to making the family work. We're going to push through this. We're going to get through it and keep the family together. It seems to play out now with such regularity that I just can't believe it. In the aftermath of such a traumatic event, that everyone can just stand up and say, we're going to move on and make things right, especially when half the country is yelling at their TVs, telling the wives to, you know, dump the loser. So I thought, why not, if we want to get a taste of what happens in real life, dip into our own listeners' experiences with this. And it's not an easy thing to ask about, but we asked about it. One of the people we heard from was Tony Froelich. And Tony, understandably, was not terribly interested in having this conversation, you know, with his wife and his kids right there. So on a kind of a scratchy phone line, we were able to reach him on his drive home. Is that right, Tony? From the Twin Cities to Stillwater, Minnesota.
That's correct.
Okay, well, thanks for taking a few minutes to talk with me. Tell me what happened and what's going on with you now.
I was having an affair that was exposed and ended in the middle of February. And I hope to stay together with my wife, but even at this point, 4 months later, nothing's for sure. So it's surprising when you see these politicians come out the day after they are exposed and they're saying that everything will be okay and they'll be staying with their family.
What was it like for you the day after things were exposed?
It was pretty darn quiet. I think it was probably 2 or 3 days before my wife even spoke to me again.
The affair itself, how did it happen?
It was a person that I work with. I work for a very large organization, and so we have people actually all over the country. We had met in person at one point at a bar, and then we had continued discussions via email, and that lasted for about 4 weeks.
And how serious did it get?
It got to the point of discussing plans for a physical meeting, trying to figure out where between the two of us would be a place to meet.
But that physical meeting never actually happened?
That's correct.
Okay. I don't know if one can rank such things, but compared with, say, escaping multiple times to Argentina to hang out with your mistress, I mean, this was a low-level affair, or at least it stopped or was stopped at an early stage.
That's correct.
And yet, that quite nearly wrecked, or may have wrecked, you don't know, your marriage.
That's also correct, yes. Still trying to figure out where we're going to go from here. There have been people that tell my spouse that she should just get out.
And what's the goal for the two of you you know, to say you're gonna work through this, and if the marriage continues, is it to put it behind you? How do you think of the goal here? How do you characterize it?
It's always going to be there. I guess my goal is to put back behind us so that we can move on with our lives. But at the same time, for me, keeping it enough that I learn from my mistakes and never make that mistake again.
What do you think her answer would be in terms of what the goal is here?
I think she wants to keep our family together. I think part of the reason that she didn't leave right on the spot was the kids. But at the same time, she's also said that if we can't work it out, then we can't work it out, and she'll leave.
Tony, thanks for talking with me on your drive home to Stillwater, and thanks for your openness about this. I hope that's helpful for you. Is it?
Yeah, that's one thing I've learned is sharing and openness and using the other resources, friends and family to help work through stuff.
Well, it's good to hear your story, and best of luck.
Thank you.
And that was Tony Froelich. And here's a bit of an email response. We heard from Elizabeth, last name withheld, who confides that her previous marriage broke up after both she and her husband had affairs. And speaking from that experience, she doesn't think much of the political theatrics we see in cases like this. She writes, "Know what? If it was my husband, not that I'm stupid enough to marry a politician, I would not be shouldering any of the burden. If I was there at all at a press conference, it would be to make a statement that I'm madder than hell, the other woman better not darken my doorstep, and if the media bugs me about it, I'll have their heads on a pike outside my door. The wives in these cases are feeding the public's view that politicians are somehow more trustworthy than the rest of us." Thank you, Elizabeth. A quite different reaction to these wives, and I guess their politician husbands as well, came to us from another woman who did not want her name used to protect the reputation of her child. When she sees these wives standing next to their husbands at a press conference or issuing statements saying that they're committed to making the marriage work, to keeping the family together, she's not angry with them. She is, if anything, a little bit jealous.
Basically, what happened is my ex-spouse was unfaithful, and then instead of trying to work things out, which I really wanted to do, just left. And there was no opportunity to discuss why and what and how. It just was done. And I really value long-term commitments in marriage and thought my marriage would be for the rest of my life. So when this happened, it was shocking. And 3 years later, still hard to deal with. So when I see, you know, people in the public eye or in other arenas of my life who are at least trying to work it out, I don't know, part of me thinks that I wish that I would have had that opportunity. So it's good to see it up there, but it also kind of can be painful for me and probably the rest of us who didn't get that opportunity.
What were the details of your husband's affair, to the extent that you feel comfortable sharing them?
It was a coworker. They were friends and I guess took it to the next level, then told me about it afterward.
It became physical,
yes,
I guess.
That definitely occurred, yes.
Why did you want to work it out? So many people would look at these politicians' wives, and I think their gut reaction, maybe having not been in that situation, is to say, dump the jerk.
Yeah. I don't know. I think with me, I had a young son, and initially I thought it was a husband who was maybe not happy after having a child and acted out and made a mistake. And so at the time, I thought, well, everyone can make mistakes. Let's at least work on this and see if we can fix whatever caused the unhappiness. And so in my mind, I was like, okay, this is the worst thing that could happen. Something was wrong in our marriage, and this is the turning point where we can either make it even better than it was before, or it wouldn't work out. But I thought that having been through something so horrific, it could have brought us closer.
What was your thinking about why, rather than, you know, taking some sort of other action to end your marriage, I guess, which may have been your husband's goal, why he had an affair and went about it, you know, surreptitiously?
That is something I will never know. And that is kind of, at least when you do spend the time to try to work through a marriage, you probably get to know the root cause of why an affair happened. And that is something I'll never know.
Well, it's very generous of you to share your difficult experience with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
A listener there from Minneapolis, whose name, at her request, we're going to keep to ourselves. I'm sure you understand. And this right here is where this segment on infidelity and politicians' wives and all that was going to end, and it would have been a fine place to end. But then, at the last minute, I got a call back from Tony Froelich. I'm sure you remember Tony. Cheated on his wife. We heard from him a few minutes ago. I had mentioned in passing to Tony that I'd be interested in talking with his wife if, by some chance, she should be up for such a thing. As it turns out, she was. And so Annie Froelich is on the phone with me now. Annie, thanks very much for talking with me.
Not a problem.
So in your words, tell me what happened. What did your husband do?
Well, my husband had an affair. I found out from the other woman's husband. They were having an inappropriate discussions, as he put it. Hmm. I definitely was not happy, and I don't think we spoke for 2 or 3 days. I kicked him out of to the couch. We weren't sharing a bedroom for quite a while.
Mm-hmm. What were you thinking in those first days?
Yeah, it's kind of, how do you just get past the initial shock? I guess I thought I would like it to work. We have 3 kids together, mm-hmm. and we've been together for 8 years, so there's a lot of history there. So it was definitely worth giving it a try, in my mind.
Did you contemplate, you know, whether and how you could ever get past something like that?
Oh, yeah, I did, for sure. I still have bad days where I think, well, what am I doing? Why am I still in this house giving this a try? Why, you know, why am I putting up with this? I should, you know, I deserve better than this.
Do you believe him that he wants to make it work and that this kind of thing will never happen again?
I do. I've had my doubts. We were going to counseling for quite some time, and it was probably, I don't know, like a month and a half after all of this came out, where he had said nothing physical ever happened, it was all just talking, that I found out that he did. They were together at a bar, and there was lots of kissing, and he drove her to her hotel, and nothing ever happened at the hotel, but he still got out of the car hoping to be invited upstairs. And so that was another time when there was, you know, a few days of no talking. I left for, I don't know, like 4 days with the kids and was again thrown back into that. What mm-hmm. else is not being told? You know, is this really something I want to do?
You sound like at least mentally, you're living your life, you know.
Right.
You sound, if I might say, like remarkably upbeat to me talking about this.
You know, and I told Tony this right away, that this isn't going to be something I'm hiding. This is your mistake. And so if anybody's around us and they notice something is different, they should be aware of it in advance. So I've not hid anything about it.
One last question, I guess, for you. When you see this kind of thing playing out on the news, what are your thoughts with regard to the politicians' wives in particular?
You know what it is it has to do with they like the lifestyle and they like the money, to be perfectly honest. And I think that that happens a lot. You see it not even with politicians, but with Hollywood stars like Mel Gibson having his girlfriend on the side for years. Mm. My dad is a physician. I've seen it with physicians' wives who turn a blind eye because they like the prestige of being a physician's wife. So it's kind of that prestige that comes along with being the politician's wife.
And how long have you and Tony been married?
December 1st, 2003. So 6 years.
Well, however things turn out, I wish you both, and you especially, I suppose, since this is, you know, you didn't get yourself into the situation, I wish you the best.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for speaking so frankly with me about this.
Yep, not a problem.
Annie Froelich of Stillwater, Minnesota, rounding out our good, long, deep breath of marital infidelity there. But before we depart this topic, a little bomb thrown by our buddy Dave Pounder, a listener down in Florida who also happens to be a porn producer who is currently working on a book about infidelity, he tells us. Here's Dave's take.
Sanford, John Edwards, Bill Clinton, all these people are basically acting within the evolutionary model of males. Most males are behaving like this. We can't talk about it socially. If their wives ask them, they can't admit it, because if they do, the emotional intimacy is broken, which is why the only way for a man and a woman to have a successful relationship is where a man and a woman are in a quote-unquote committed relationship where the man is cheating and the woman is unaware. That is the only way.
Floridian porn producer Dave Pounder sounds an awful lot like what I learned in my biological anthropology classes back in college. Interestingly, there's a big fat article in the latest Newsweek suggesting that everything we think we know about the way males and females behave in these contexts is wrong, and challenging what Dave Pounder has to say there. But Dave, thanks for getting in touch. And because you did, we're going to slip in a little bit of bed music here from The Smarts and Me, featuring a little instrument that we actually like to refer to as the porn tar, because of that delightful quality. Dave and everybody else we heard from in that segment got in touch with us because they got our question through our email list. They are, as we say, in our network. And we would like to have you in our network as well. If you're not there yet, you can sign up by going to intheloopshow.net. And, of course, it is an entirely separate but equally wonderful thing to become our fan on Facebook. You can do that at loopfacebook.net, where we're rolling out all kinds of content as we get it in. It is up to the minute, or up to the day, as the case may be. Speaking of, speaking of pornography, a short update to an interview we did on the last episode of In the Loop. This law in China that is requiring all new computers sold in the country to include censoring software to, as the government says, block pornography especially, but maybe political content as well. Well, that law, the implementation of it anyway, is being postponed. The Chinese government says that computer makers are not ready to comply. But it's also fair to say they have gotten a lot of heat, plenty of skepticism about this particular idea. They must be listening to In the Loop. In any case, the Chinese government says it is still going to happen. It's just being postponed. Speaking not at all of pornography, at least I don't think so, Sandon Totten has just entered the studio. Sandon, thanks for coming by.
That might be the weirdest intro you've ever given me.
Well, it all depends on what you have to talk about, doesn't it? But you are here with the latest, what were we calling this, the Scribbit?
Scribbit cast, yep.
And explain to people one more time briefly what the Scribbit is.
Well, a Scribbit is a little widget we have up on our website, and basically you can just go there and type something in there and tell us to investigate something, anything you want.
Okay, we've done this a few times now. We'll do it a few times more. I was kind of playing around, and I figured if we're going to do it that much, it needs a little theme song.
Oh,
so
really?
So I made a little theme song for it. Do you want to hear it?
Yeah.
All right. Get ready.
I am so ready.
Scream it. What do you think?
I'm flattered, I guess.
Well, it doesn't say Sanitaten.
I know, but you know, my segment is the first time I think I've ever had a theme song for anything I've done.
Oh, good. I'm glad you like it. I don't know what the folks at Scribbit Inc. would think about that, but there you have it. I'm sure they're glad we're using their product so prominently. So you've picked a couple items out of the Scribbit that listeners have suggested for us to check into, and I'll let you lead it off. What do
well,
you got?
Actually, I've got a theme song to present to you too, because I noticed a trend forming in the Scribbit, and so I thought I would do a sort of themed Scribbit cast this week. See if you can guess what it is.
Why, it's the Mr. Rogers theme music, of course.
Good ear, Jeff. Good ear.
Oh, yeah. It takes a genius.
So the first thing someone wrote into us on this Mr. Rogers theme was they said, you know, I love the Mr. Rogers How Stuff Is Made segments, you know, with Mr. McFeely, the postman, delivering these little tapes, and then they'd see, you know, how a guitar was made or a chair or whatever other thing was made.
Oh, okay.
And so he wondered, the writer, wondered, what about condoms and magnets?
Condoms and magnets. Now, I don't think Mr. McFeely ever dealt with condoms.
Well, I'm sure he did, probably not on the show.
Magnets, I don't recall. Let's start with that one. Magnets, how they're made. What did you learn?
Okay, well, I used to think that magnets kind of like fell to earth like kryptonite or something, and there was only a certain amount of them, and you know they had to put little small pieces of them in those like marbles you'd get at space camp.
This is what you thought up until a few days ago when you started looking into this?
It never occurred to me that you could actually make magnets from scratch. There's two kinds of magnets. There's electromagnets, and then there's the sort of standard magnets that we're used to sticking on a fridge or whatever. Mm-hmm. Electromagnets are basically you take a piece of metal, you run some electricity through it, and you create two poles. You got a magnet. Mm-hmm. The other kind is a little bit harder. So you start with a piece of metal, and you got to take this metal and heat it up so it's super hot to the point where it's like bright red. And then you stick that in an electromagnet. And when it's all bright red like that and molten, the particles kind of separate out and sort of get attracted to the north pole and the south pole of the electromagnet. And then you quickly cool it down and freeze it like that.
The hunk of metal.
The hunk of metal. Okay. You freeze it so that it's stuck sort of with half the particles going to the north and half going to the south. And boom, you got this magnet.
And you actually interviewed a guy who runs it like a magnet making business to figure this out, right?
Right. He told me all about it. He said he worked in magnet factories for like 40 years. The sad news is magnet factories now are all in China. So even if Mr. McFeely did want to go and find out how magnets were made, unless PBS was willing to send them, you know, to Asia, probably the segment wouldn't have gotten very far.
Hmm. Well, that is an interesting way of getting us to the other listener question. They want to know how condoms were made. And as a matter of fact, you mentioned to me you were thinking about that, and I said, well, I have been myself to a condom factory. So
no
maybe
joke.
I'll handle
that.
This one. And that was not in China, but in Japan.
Right.
This was during a period where I was working for a newspaper in Japan, and I was, I don't know, I had just freedom to cover all kinds of wacky stuff, like pitching my editors on stories on what the Israeli mafia was doing in Tokyo, and claw video games where instead of going for stuffed toys, you know, you would go for live lobsters. It's just all kinds of wacky
stuff.
This
explains a lot about how you got to be where you are today.
Maybe. My formative reporting experience there in Tokyo. Well, it turns out Japan is one of the world's top condom producers.
Really?
Yeah, and at the peak of technology.
Wow.
Maybe at the height of my hubris in my reporting assignment there, and creativity, maybe. I was also 22 years old, so go figure. I pitched my bosses on, hey, what if I went to a condom factory, and we did a story about that, and I just thought I'd see if they'd go for it, and they did. As it turns out, there's no great magic to it. Just imagine huge rooms full of condom-shaped molds that and the rubber is
that's a diplomatic way of putting it
poured on top of them, and they're just whirring past you constantly all over the place, and it was all very, very sanitary and completely protected. I was viewing the whole thing through windows, and everybody was wearing, you know, clean suits and all that stuff.
Protection, of course.
To make sure that there was no contamination that occurred. It did make for a very interesting photo on the front page of the feature section of the newspaper I was working for, that's for sure.
My one question is, do they have a way of testing them to make sure that they're going to do, you know, their function?
They did have, they had an extensive testing lab, and I hadn't thought about that in a while. It's a good question. Among other things, I remember they had machines that would stretch them as far as they could go. Mm-hmm. And they had machines that would blow them up to see if they would pop.
Or if they had a leak in air or anything.
Yeah, I don't believe they were doing any human testing this particular facility. If they did, they didn't give me a guided tour of that part. It was fascinating, Japanese condom factory. So there's your little Mr. McFeely moment.
All right.
And you said we had a theme going here along Mr. Rogers' lines.
Yeah.
So where do we go from here?
Okay, I want to keep us going with the sound effects. So for our next segment, let's play this. So that, of course, is the trolley that Mr. Rogers uses to go to the neighborhood of make-believe.
Woo-hoo!
Which is kind of where we're heading next. A listener asked us to look into the curious case of Michael Kinsel, who is this 18-year-old kid from San Diego who thought he was going to be the next Mr. Rogers.
And you and I had noticed this story ahead of time because it sort of had a little kerfluffle in public media land where we live. And it is very interesting. So I'm glad that somebody went to the Scribbit and brought it up.
Yeah, I mean, basically what he was doing was he was announcing this big event in Escondido, California. All these celebrities were going to show up, and they were basically going to pass off the red card again to him and have him take over the Mr. Rogers franchise. Here's a clip of him talking about it on a local TV show.
And this is the man behind it, 18-year-old Michael Kinsel.
So in honor of Fred Rogers' life, the Children's Media Foundation here in San Diego is going to be hosting what we hope to be one of the biggest celebrity gala San Diego has ever seen. It's very exciting.
He came to our studio.
And this was all going down just a couple of months ago.
Right. It's supposed to happen at the end of May. You know, all these celebrities would be there, from Sarah Jessica Parker, Prince, Danny DeVito, Governor Schwarzenegger,
Bette Midler.
Yeah, right.
Big Bird.
Anybody who's anybody was going to be there to celebrate the unveiling of Michael Kinsel.
Uh-huh. Well, and the celebration of Fred Rogers' life, of course,
right.
is how he couched it. But yes, it was both things.
Surprise, surprise. None of this was actually happening.
No.
It was all make-believe or something. You know, it turns out that the celebrities contacted said they had never even heard of Michael Kinsel. PBS had said they, you know, wanted nothing to do with this kid, basically. I really wanted to know what was going through his mind. Did he think he'd get away with this? Did he really think he would become the next Fred Rogers? I tried contacting Michael Kinsel himself, but, you know, he's not talking to anybody right now.
You got him on his cell phone for, 10 seconds.
Right. Brushed me off very politely. So I got in touch with Drew Sefton, who reports for this publication called Current, which basically covers public radio, public TV. And she had spoken quite at length with Michael Kinsel.
Before he went into lockdown.
Right.
Yeah.
And she said, in all her years of reporting, she had never encountered anybody quite like Mr. Kinsel.
We don't even know how old he is at this point. That's how mysterious this all is.
No, wait, really?
Yeah.
So the 18 is alleged?
Exactly. Some of the sources that I had talked to said, oh, no, he's older than that. And then some said, oh, no, he's younger than that.
So you talked personally with Michael Kinsel. You said you talked to him for a while doing this reporting. What's he like as a person?
He was extremely laser-focused on his message. And when you would try to get any specifics out of him, or even, you know, after a while, I just came out and told him, Michael, what you're telling me is impossible. You say that Bette Midler is going to be there. Bette Midler is performing in Las Vegas, and she has a show that night. And there'd be just a slight pause, and he would say, but it's going to be a wonderful tribute, and it's such a great thing to support this great public broadcasting system that we have. And even when a normal person would have gotten angry or gotten frustrated or hung up, he never did. It was just impossible to rattle him. At one point, I said, Michael, I said, I know that you have lied. I can prove that. What would Mr. Rogers say about that, Michael? And that was one of the only points that he paused. And he said, this is going to be a lovely tribute. That's how weird this was.
So what's your read on why he did it?
I'm not really sure. I mean, there's a lot of possibilities, but I couldn't even come to any conclusions. I mean, he could have been just really obsessed with Mr. Rogers, and he could have been doing this from the bottom of his heart. This could have been a hoax. It could have been a scam. Maybe he started out thinking, oh, maybe we'll be able to do something with this and make some money off of it. There's just no way to know.
Have we heard the last of Michael Kinsel? We don't know. But, Sandin, is there a Mr. Rogers style lesson that we might take from all this?
Well, I kind of see this as a, you know, you can be anything you want kind of a story, with the asterisk on the internet. Also, I think it's important to keep in mind here, it's okay to visit the land of make-believe, but just don't live there.
All right, Sandin, thanks very much for checking into some more stuff from our Scribbit. The Scribbit is there at intheloopshow.net. So visit the Scribbit and scribble your thoughts about what Sandin can check into for our Scribbit cast segment here. One more time, the Scribbit theme.
Scribbit!
And now, Sandin, we're going to try a bit of an experiment. Are you up for an experiment?
Totally.
Okay. When we, you and I, got some listeners together in person a few months ago here at Minnesota Public Radio, people were nostalgic, you might say, for some of the things we used to do in our live audience version of the show.
Right.
In particular.
They loved the connection, the talking, the sort of conversation back and forth we used to get there.
Right. And especially the fact that they, you know, quote unquote, ordinary people could come and talk about stuff that was in the news, you know, whatever we were dealing with for the theme for that particular show. They could engage on it and offer their insights and informed opinions about it. And so a few of them lit on a notion to maybe try and approach that idea in our current format.
How would we do that?
Well, it's a rather interesting notion that we would essentially just cold call a member of our audience and engage them on whatever was in the news.
What kind of crazy person would let us do that?
Well, I know. And we did. We have a couple people on our list who said they'd be willing to try it, you know, and go out on a limb. And so We're going to try the first of those. This guy lives in Minneapolis. His name is Colin Ernst, and the phone is ringing.
Good afternoon. This is Colin.
Colin, this is Jeff Horwich from In the Loop.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for being our first contestant on... we're going to call you up and ask random questions about stuff in the news.
Love it.
If you don't mind me asking, what are you in the middle of at the moment?
I work at a company that does IT sales. Actually just digging through a customer's computer list to see if their computers can handle some new software. And the resounding answer is no. If your computer is 8 years old, it probably can't handle any new software.
Well, let me ask you about healthcare reform. Doesn't that sound like a fun topic to spend a couple of minutes on? How closely are you following the healthcare bill saga right now?
Yeah, pretty closely. I've been keeping an eye on it, and it sounds like they... Obama and some people are pushing for the whole the public option. Of course, everybody's up in arms about it, which is kind of funny to me because originally they're up in arms about it because, well, we can't have a government option because if you have, the government can't do anything right. Just look at the DMV. They can't do anything. Mm-hmm. And then they quickly change their tune to, well, if the government does it, then they're going to put everybody else out of business.
What's your own healthcare situation like? Do you feel like this is something that's going to have a big bearing on you, depending on what they pass?
I'm working for a company that does give me healthcare. They give me decent healthcare. I've never been a big fan of any sort of health insurance company. They just don't seem to do a good job, and they seem to spend most of their money making sure that they don't pay for my healthcare bills.
Have you got specific experiences, with your health insurance company that give you this kind of sour impression of the system as it is today?
Yeah, most of my really negative experience has been friends and family members having to fight for big things. I'm lucky. I'm young. I'm healthy. I haven't had any really big problems with my health.
How old are you?
30. So, I've been in pretty good shape. I haven't had to worry too much about it, but I've certainly known plenty of people that have had to just fight for months and months or years to try to get something paid.
So you follow the news pretty closely, which is why we thought it'd be a good idea to talk to you for this. Do people in your office and who you surround yourself with generally have conversations about this kind of thing? Healthcare reform, for example, people talking about it?
Yeah, pretty regularly. Really? I would say that the vast majority of the people I work with are dramatically more conservative than I am. I work with a bunch of salespeople, so... they tend to lean more conservative.
But the people in your office and your friends, they're not checked out. They're paying attention and they care about this.
Yes.
Very good to hear, I guess.
Yeah. I'll say that I'm not a big fan of the sources that most of the people in my office are using. Mm-hmm. I don't consider Rush Limbaugh and O'Reilly to be reliable sources of information. But at least they're trying to keep themselves informed in some way.
And I imagine you're aware of what's going on over in Iran, perhaps?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that seems pretty great, actually, if they can actually pull it off. People have actually come out to fight to have their vote. And the people of Iran really, at least the majority of the people in Iran, seemingly, want something different than what they've got.
Doesn't it feel to you just a little bit, though, like this is just kind of petering out day by day? I mean, fewer people are coming out and, attention is turning from it. I don't know. It's just this sort of like feeling of kind of dripping away. Like if the people who are in power in Iran can keep this at bay long enough, everyone else will forget about it. And that may be coming to pass.
Yeah, I am a little concerned about that. And that's another reason why I'm kind of disappointed there's nothing we can really do. It's not going the way I would have hoped, but it's nice to see that there was actually something there.
Hmm.
Maybe it makes it easier in the future to do it. Maybe somehow they pull it off this time. I don't know.
Do you think this is the kind of thing that brings brings Americans together, those conservative people in your office who you may argue with about healthcare? Do you find that you all kind of share the same instincts and emotions when it comes to Iran?
I would say on this matter, for the most part, yes. Big difference would be that they tend to lean more towards we as a nation and Obama as president should be coming out more forcefully in favor of the new guy, mm-hmm. of Mousavi. I tend to be more on the side of you know, there are a lot of people in Iran that are kind of, you know, maybe on the fence about the guy. They support him, they want to go out for him, but they also really don't like us. So I think you'd be taking a lot of his internal support away if we came out too forcefully in support of him.
Well, Colin, thanks very much for letting me really quite seriously surprise you and ask you about a bunch of things that you had no idea were coming.
It was my pleasure, actually. This was a lot of fun. I hope I get a chance to do it again.
Yeah, you certainly do follow your news, and thanks for going out on a limb for us.
My pleasure.
All right, Colin.
Talk to you later, Jeff.
Thanks a lot,
day.
Colin. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Colin Ernst of Minneapolis, our inaugural listener cold call, or whatever we might call it, clearly on top of the news. Nice job, Colin. Thank you very much. And, you know, it is a very small band of people who might be up for such a thing, but if you think you might be among them, get in touch with us at our website, intheloopshow.net. Just click the contact link and shoot us a note. We'll put you on the list. Now we have come to our final segment of the podcast, and I had promised some fresh Minnesota Senate race music way back when we began this episode, oh so long ago. I was thinking about it that afternoon when our Minnesota Supreme Court decision came down. The first notice I got of this was on Twitter. And then I got another notice on Twitter. And then another. And another. And pretty soon it was a giant Twitter fest. A Twitter explosion, you might say, of, as it turned out, people very, very happy with what had happened. And for many people, maybe not for you, but for many people, Twitter was integral to the experience of that moment. And so just moments after that was all going down, I sat down myself and tried to capture that in music. When at first the news came out, there arose a mighty cheer from a million silent voices all across my Twitter sphere. My God, it's done, he finally won. Hey, have you heard? It's true. So I'm typing out this very special message just for you. And you, well, it's a Twitter celebration. Hearty self-congratulation. It's like a giant block party in a giant tent, except we're all at our computers and we've never met. I think this one's good to go. Got my emoticon placed just so. Everybody joining in to have their say. There's one Republican on Twitter, but he's quiet today. As most days seems, the gang and I will take the same routine. Maybe tweet about our cube mates and the crazy stuff we've seen. But today is something special, and if you log in, you'll see. My Twitterverse is tweeting now in four-part harmony. I'm talking hashtag MN contest, hashtag Senate seat, hashtag finally over, hashtag this is sweet. It's a Twitter celebration, slapping backs with all my friends, where the loop goes on forever and the party never ends. All right, a true exercise in deadline songwriting. Sometimes you just never know what you're going to get. And remember, I kid because I love. If you want to follow us on Twitter, you can find us. Well, we link to it from our website and all that good stuff, but you can go straight to twitter.com/intheloop. And that is us. We are also, of course, on Facebook, which is loopfacebook.net. And as a matter of fact, you can go there or to our regular website, and there's a little video of me singing that little ditty right there. If you feel like you need to hear it again and want to actually see four of me on the screen at one time. Sandon Totten, of course, our producer. You heard from him with our little Scribblecast segment a little while ago, but he is deeply involved in everything that we do, so a round of applause for Sandon Totten. He and I produce In the Loop. And, boy, that's about it. Let me mention the Smarts with all the fun, nice-sounding bed music we use throughout the show. And one other little thing. If you want to... if you're feeling like you need more Minnesota-specific music, I didn't put it in the podcast because it would seem a little obscure maybe to people who are listening from outside Minnesota, and there are a number of you. But if you're in Minnesota here and you've been following our unallotment controversy with our governor slashing budgets unilaterally. Well, I teamed up with Dale Connolly, who is well-known here in Minnesota, hosts Radio Heartland, formerly of The Morning Show, who wrote some nifty little satirical lyrics about that unallotment deal, and asked me if I would do my best Bobby Darin impersonation and sing his song for him, a little tune called Tim the Pen. If you want to hear that, you can find that on our website as well, in theloopshow.net. And with that, I'm officially out of things to say. Until next time, this is In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich. Thanks, everybody.